Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be here. Just a few remarks before I start. The first one is probably unnecessary because Marty explained to me that it's informal and there are a lot of questions, possibly disagreements. But I do want to encourage that because the main aim for my talk is to try to entice some of you to work on these problems so that the more you understand, of course, the more likely that is to happen. So don't hesitate to interrupt at any time. Maybe this is the one place where this remark actually has some significance. Long and bitter experience teaching has led me to the hypothesis that this remark is irrelevant and it depends only on the audience and the personal style of the lecturer, whether questions are asked. But that may be a pessimistic view. Also, I wish, if I may, to advertise the talks of my friends and collaborators, Reinhard Berger at 10 o'clock on Wednesday, and Yuan Lo on Thursday at 10 o'clock. And this talk, the beginning of this talk, and maybe more of it, will provide background for theirs. I'll be more specific when I actually start the substance in a minute, how that is. Next, I just want to indicate the talks, in some sense, are very basic and simple. There are only two components to the talks, population genetics and dynamical systems. So for the population geneticists, the models will be well known. And for the rest, if something is not clear, please ask. In any talk, one has to make, I think, a large number of difficult decisions. And what I decided to do, partly in the light of what I said the aim is to give you formulation, give you theorems, some remarks and examples, but no proofs whatsoever. That doesn't mean that if you ask, we can't discuss it, although a lot of the proofs are long and elaborate, and I can't go to the blackboard for some of them and produce the whole thing. If there were more time, I would probably still do the same, but attempt to give more examples. I have worked for 35 years on migration problems. Let me backtrack. I would say over half my time I've worked on a lot of other things in the field. And I should also clarify that the large part of that time was on neutral models with random genetic drift, which I won't talk about. And I feel my intuition is entirely unsatisfactory after those 35 years. I don't know why that is. Of course, it could be just my stupidity, but I don't know if anybody has really good intuition. There's something elusive, I think, about this. So after this, we'll get started, and I hope you are good at deciphering hieroglyphics because I still work this way. You have already had some talks in population genetics, so you probably have a good idea of what the subject is about. For the purpose of this talk, and for a lot of population genetics, I think it's fair to say that what we try to do is use the observed pattern of variation, partially from the field, partially from laboratory experiments, to infer the action of evolutionary forces. Okay? And in the migration selection models, if selection varies in space, okay, there are two particularly important features that make them interesting. And one is, as you have already seen and you heard, I think, from Dick Hudson, if you were here, and Bob Griffiths, we need variation in order to conclude anything. And migration and selection is able to maintain genetic variation in some cases when pure selection cannot. And the second point is that a phenomenon that's very common in nature is that of a cline, which is a stable pattern of spatial variation in phenotypes. If those phenotypes have an underlying genetic basis, which is almost invariably the case, I'm not saying they're entirely genetic, but they are partially genetic or fully genetic, then this kind of model provides an explanation. Not necessarily the only possible explanation, It could be just random variation. But it's a natural one, and in fact, I would say that the origin of serious work on this is precisely this, a 1948 paper of Haldane's. Okay, now I want to, Marty, would it be very bad if I ripped this off?
No, I'm not too.
So that I can slide the, okay, sorry. All right, so now we get to some perspective on how we go about this, and there is one way that's much better than any other. It's not the way I thought about it when I came into the field, but in a few years I got convinced, and that is to always start your modeling in discrete space and discrete time. In a deterministic problem, such as we're going to talk about, you can write down equations otherwise, but the penalty for going in the continuum immediately, which was my outlook, I also came in from theoretical physics into this, you have much higher dimensionality. That's one penalty. The second disadvantage is that it's much more difficult to put in biological complications, separate sexes, X-linkage and so on. So it doesn't give you an integrated picture. So most population geneticists think this way, and I think it's correct. I will call these models DD for discrete space, discrete time. And then we have nonlinear difference equations, mathematically speaking. And one advantage of this is that, as you will see, we have some simple special cases that's highly prized because they're hard to come by. Now, if you're willing to agree for the purpose of these talks, this is the way to go about it, then I look upon every other model as an approximation of this one. That doesn't mean that ultimately in a particular case for a population, the other model is not more accurate. Okay? It's just the way I like to get it. And I'll digress again because I always keep in mind Marty said it's informal. And I would like to encourage any of you who might work in the field to pay a lot of attention to formulation, because it's often not, I don't mean just in this talk, but in general, it's often quite interesting and it's quite revealing in itself. And it's usually not done very cleanly or lucidly by people trained in biology. And sometimes there are quite interesting mathematical problems in the formulation itself, for example, in making these approximations. Okay, so there are three approximations we can derive from this, and I guess I should have said, so Reinhard Berger on Wednesday is going to talk about multi-locus versions of this model. I'll just talk about one locus. It's hard enough for me. Okay, and as a physician would tell you, you will be in good hands when he's talking to you. So. I will talk also about this approximation, which is the following. If evolution is occurring slowly, then we can make a simple approximation. This is not hard. And stay discrete in space but go to continuous time. And then we get nonlinear differential equations. Sometimes this is more tractable. Differential equations typically are easier. But we lose one of the instructive special cases if you do this. Okay. Then what we can also do is go to continuous space but keep time discrete. Okay, in that case, we have nonlinear integral difference equations, and this has received the least attention, I would imagine, because it's very difficult. I don't think it's in any way uninteresting biologically, and therefore there are not many results. Okay, and lastly, I want to strongly urge you also to come and hear you and Lo on Thursday, and he will talk about continuous space and continuous time. You see these designations, and that's the diffusion model. And this approximation from here to here is quite non-trivial. He won't be talking about the approximation that has been done. He'll be talking about results. But it's a very interesting thing. And I should also add, when you make these approximations, you learn which are the important combinations of parameters, because typically when you make an approximation, some of the parameters collapse into various products. So I think in general in population genetics, this is the way to proceed, or at least I'm just telling you the benefit of all my failures. Okay, so let's try to get to work. And since I'm being here as some kind of propagandist for population genetics, I want to next tell you, and I hope there aren't others who are not in the field but our biologists are offended. One of the things that appealed to me about this field enormously is that we can actually make biological assumptions and derive our models. And depending on how charitable I feel, I would say that is extremely uncommon in biology or unique. In other words, for us, the model is not an equation. Lotka-Volterra is not a model, it's an equation. And there's nothing behind it. It's just simple. For us, that's not like that. And to me, that's very important. Because if you confront such a model with data and the model fails, presumably if you've done your analysis right, what you need to do is remove or replace one of the assumptions. So if your model is an intuitively written down partial differential equation, it is not, to me, very, very clear how much you learn when you compare. So I find that very attractive, so I'm going to torment you by listing the assumptions in detail. Okay? And these are quite standard in population genetics. Discrete non-overlapping generations, that's already implied. The sections will be numbered, and I will always say which of the two models that I will discuss is the one at hand. Okay? I'm going to assume, so this is like an annual plan, okay? I know it seems very radical. I don't know how much time to take. It's not a bad approximation even for human beings or pigs or whatever. Anyway, that's the way we start. Monoecious diploid population. Monoecious means one house in Greek. It means that each individual has male and female sexual organs and can function either way. This is not nearly as drastic an assumption as you might feel, because if there are no sex differences, the set of loci we're looking at, then this is perfectly okay. And of course, I'm going to assume the population is diploid, the chromosomes are doubled. And I'm going to assume there are no fertility differences, so it's what we call pure viability selection. That is a drastic assumption. It's an assumption we almost always make. There's very little biological justification for it. It's simply that fertility selection is extremely difficult to treat. There is a lot of literature on it, but I'll be the last to tell you that this is necessarily covering 99% of biology, because we know that it doesn't. Okay, I'm going to assume that there is a finite number of randomly mating colonies, which we call beams. Normally, it's a shorter word. I think the word comes from right. And these exchange adult migrants independently of genotype. Every word is important. You could construct a model in which you have juvenile migration, that is, selection follows migration. There's nothing wrong with that. But we don't have 3 weeks to look at all the variants. And in those approximations, when time is continuous, the two, this makes no difference. Okay? And it is believed that qualitatively that doesn't change. The fact that migration is genotype independent, so when a population geneticist says genotype independent, it is referring only to the loci under consideration, in this case the locus under consideration. Otherwise, of course, it would be ludicrous. But the same would be true for random mating, right? There's no such thing as universal random mating, but that's not what we mean. I hope nobody is being insulted. I know the population geneticists are, but I think they also understand why I have to tell you these things, because they're often misconceived by the outsider, and they say, that's absolutely ridiculous. Are you saying people rate at random for height? No. Okay. I'm going to neglect mutation and random drift. Okay, that means that there is enough selection and migration that they're much stronger than this force. Or, to phrase it differently, I'm not going to look at timescales that are so long that mutation is important. And I'm going to assume that the beams are large enough that I don't have to worry about random drift. And that's how we get a deterministic model. Okay, I'm going to, by the way, there is unavoidably, at least if I want to give you results in a specific form, a fair amount of notation. Please don't be embarrassed if you don't remember what a symbol is. Just ask. There's a single locus with J alleles, and we conventionally call alleles capital A, not always. So they'll be labeled A1 to AJ. And the parameters in the model are constant. That, of course, doesn't have to be true. There could be long-term trends. If they're really long-term, again, I would make a timescale argument. If they fluctuate a little, they'll probably just average out. Anyway, I'm going to assume that the genotypic viabilities and the backward migration rates, I'll tell you exactly what that means, are constant. Okay, in these two lectures, I have to have some language. When I say constant, I mean time independent. When I say uniform, I mean space independent, okay? All right. And then, can everyone always see the bottom of these overheads? I carefully ask whether you can see it, not whether you can read it. Okay. So, in order to avoid confusion, I'm going to use H, I, and J, H when necessary, to denote alleles, meaning as a subscript. And the deems will be K, L, and N, because you don't always want to write a whole bunch of stuff above and below the summation sign. So my sets of alleles and deems are script J like this, and script K like that. And then we are going to be working in the simplex, which is a subset of J-dimensional Euclidean space. I think you all know this, where all the components are non-negative and they add up to one. Why is that? Because that's what gene frequencies do, and that's what we're going to follow. However, because we have K-deems, we actually are going to work in the Kronecker product of K of these simplices. Okay, and as is conventional, I'm going to denote the interior like this and the boundary like that. Okay. So far, nothing has been said. Okay. So what we need to do now is decide what our variables are. And they're, of course, the gene frequencies. And I'm going to use this notation. P sub I k at time t is the frequency of AI in zygotes. That's important. Immediately after conception. In dim K, in generation T. Okay, there are two ways to remember the subscripting. One is H, I, J, our alleles. K and then are deems. And if you like another mnemonic, the comma you could think of as a conditioning on the deem. I just don't like the ugly bar there in the subscript. And time is in generations, and it'll always go 0, 1, 2, except in a continuous model. Okay, so now we have to construct some vectors, otherwise we have too many things floating around and we see what's happening even less than we do here. So P sub I is actually a vector then, and it's the frequency of A sub I in each of the deems. That's a transpose, so I always use column vectors. Okay, so that's in the unit interval to the power k, or well, to k times direct product. Okay, and the gene frequencies in deem K I denote like this with a superscript, and that is, of course, in the simplex. I pick one deem, right? And then all of them as a collection, it makes a bigger vector, and it's in our whole space. Okay, so those are our variables. And now what I have to do is tell you a little bit about the evolutionary forces. Okay, so first we have selection acting by assumption, and that's specified by these viabilities, which are constant by assumption, and that's the probability that a zygote of genotype AIAJ located in DMK survives to reproduce. Okay, so there are capital K, and I failed to write WIJ is equal to WJI because AI is the same as AJ. So you have capital K J by J symmetric matrices there, non-negative symmetric matrices. And then if I determine only one allele for that individual, so that it's an individual who carries AI and the randomly chosen allele, then that person's or individual's fitness is actually, we denote like this, it's not the best notation, but it's been used since the 1920s, as WI, K. And it's a function of the vector of gene frequencies in that gene. It's linear, so I won't necessarily always display the argument. These are constants, these are linear functions. And what is very important is the mean viability in deem K, and we usually denote it by a W bar. It still depends on the deem, and it's like this, it's a quadratic. If you average those over PIK, you get the same thing. You can just read it off, okay? So I assume that some generous person measures these things, right? It's not my business. That's the ecologist's business as a to measure those. So next, I need to tell you just a little bit about migration, and I'm eliding a lot of complexity not showing you, so we get somewhere. And that is defined by a K by K, capital K by capital K matrix, which is called the backward migration matrix. So MKL is a constant by assumption probability that an individual in deem K came from deem L. Okay? So I ask every one of you in the room where you were born, and you all answer me. Of course, with animals, you mark them and so on. So this is measurable, and it's an input. Again, we use it. Okay? And from that, of course, I construct this what is called the backward migration matrix. And as you can see from its definition, it's a stochastic matrix. That is, each element is non-negative, and the row sums are one. Okay? And if you approach things this way, you immediately have your recursion, and you can essentially read it off. I ask what is the... Oh, I'm sorry. So population geneticists use a prime for the next generation. So prime is not a derivative, it's generation T plus one. When we get to continuous time, I will use the dot, which I don't have to explain to the physicists. Okay, I ask what is the probability if I sample a gene in deem K that it comes out AI. Okay, so I'm sampling DK. That individual came from DML with probability MKL, and the rest of this expression is simply the frequency of the gene after selection. Okay, that's a very standard model from the 1920s. All I had to do is subscript it. Okay, and I don't know whether you're interested in history. I don't think you can really ascribe this model to any single individual. I think people started to write things down this way around 1970 and so on. So it's not John Smith's model, I think. And it's fairly clear. Also, sometimes we want to look at the change in a single generation. So for the mathematicians, the delta is not the Laplacian or anything. It's this difference. Okay. So I will occasionally mention to you open problems to whet your appetite. And the first question is, when does this converge? We don't know. The answer is not always. Okay, but that's not published, but our friend and colleague Ethan Akin found a case where there is an unstable limit cycle. So it would be quite important to know when this converges. The fact that that's what he found in no way means that worse behavior can't occur, chaotic or who knows. I don't think that's an easy problem. You know, again, we're talking about almost 40 years experience, so I wrote this thing in a compressed way. If you still remember what this is, right, this map is a ratio of quadratics, and then I'm averaging it. Okay. One point, I will not write detailed references. By the way, you might remember 2.1 is our basic model when I state the theorems. Okay, because most of what I'm going to tell you is collaboration with UN Low. I want to be sure you recognize that, so I'm going to use an abbreviated referencing form. And NL7 means a paper we published in 2007, just in case you want to find things easily or whatever. Okay. So, first, I want to go to what is the simplest case of selection, which we call no dominance. Wright was very fussy about language, so he used a more awkward but much more precise term, exact semidominance. Mathematically speaking, what it means is that the two genes contribute additively. Okay? It means that there is a V such that W can be written in this form. And this actually happens quite frequently in the real world. And then Ewan and I have a theorem which says, suppose we have our basic model 2.1 and that there's no dominance. That's how I'm going to be writing the results for you. Then the number of beams, and if there's no selection in a certain number of beams, we can subtract those, is a generic upper bound on the number of alleles present at equilibrium. Okay, one has to be very careful about what a statement like that means, right? I'm not saying it's always an upper bound. I'm saying that it's the probability that it's not an upper bound is zero. Okay, there's a set of measure zero possibly where it's not true. But that's not particularly important. Also, please remember, we don't...
Measure zero with respect to the initial conditions or with respect to what?
The parameters and the initial conditions.
Parameters.
Good question, thank you. Yes. And also, please remember, this statement does not assert that you can't have forever more alleles than beams, because we don't know that it converges to equilibrium. Okay? Well, I said this already. Here. But it doesn't refer just to stable equilibrium. Okay. I guess it's all here, right? Okay. The theorist, of course, is never happy because if I prove something for you that you consider obvious and you're a biologist, you're going to tell me it's obvious and it's a waste of time. That's one reason to be unhappy. This is, I think, not obvious, but what is unsatisfactory is that I don't know why it's true. I'll get back to that point. What I mean by I don't know why it's true is that the proof doesn't teach you why it's true. And the hypotheses that I could come up with, biological hypotheses, do not work. But it's true. Why doesn't it tell you? Because you do some linear algebra and you count variables and count equations. That doesn't tell you anything. It just tells you that it's true. Okay. So, if we're in the unfortunate situation that we don't really know what that system does in general, then a very natural idea, which has many applications, is to consider cases where one of those two evolutionary forces dominates the other. So there are obviously two such cases, and that's what I want to discuss with you. Yes?
I guess I have one more question. If you say it's not obvious that it converges, so that also means that the equilibrium, I guess equilibrium means that it's a time-independent state.
Correct.
The system, right? So
a steady state, if you wish.
It could be more than one equilibrium.
Oh, sure. But the theorem...
But this is true for any equilibrium.
Yes. There's no assumption about the number of equilibria or their stability.
An equilibrium just means stationary state, or does it mean
yes.
detailed balance? Or,
pardon me?
Or does it imply some kind of detailed balance?
Oh, no. There's no reason to assume anything like detailed balance in population generics.
Just P prime that, equal to...
Pardon me?
P prime equal P is equilibrium. Right?
Yes, exactly. That's whatever. I prefer equilibrium. It's short, simple, steady state. Yeah, is just as good or whatever you want to call it. Yes. Okay. Pardon? Yes.
It was basically a statement that in each team you sustain one allele.
Pardon me?
In each team you have one allele.
No.
But without.
No, I didn't say that. All I said is that the entire population, generically, at equilibrium will not have more alleles than beams. I didn't say that each beam has one allele. Pardon?
It has at most one allele.
At most.
I mean, there could be alleles shared.
No. Why? You could have every allele in every gene. You mean? No. That is not a statement that is being made. That's a question of how it's distributed. In fact, generically, that's not the case, because generically, if the backward migration matrix is irreducible, do you understand? Then every allele will be in every gene. So no, that's not true. Do you understand? Maybe at a very low frequency. Yes.
Yeah, that's what I had in mind.
Pardon me?
That's what I had in mind, that the generic situation to reach that upper bound would be that you have the one dominant allele in most, in each gene.
Well, not necessarily. I could have K deems and K alleles and all of them present at a high frequency. Almost anything is possible, unfortunately. That's not true. Yes?
From a biologist standpoint, how robust is the result? I mean, if I go out and measure so many alleles at a locus where I think it's reasonably assumptions hold, can I say from that that provides an inference on the number of genes?
If all the assumptions hold, then it's true with probability 1. Or as your neighbor asked, it's true for a set of full measure in the parameters, namely the selection parameters and migration parameters and the initial data. The initial data don't really matter because we're talking about equilibrium. Well, they might if there are multiple equilibria. But anyway, yes. Then you should find it, yes.
So do you think this would be a reasonable way to estimate the number of genes if you don't know that?
Well, provided you are going to be able to assure me that it's at equilibrium. Which is not easy.
So it rests, of course, on the fact that the mutations are neglected.
Yes.
So that no new alleles are generated.
Yes, correct.
So,
absolutely.
Is there any natural population where that limit is the relevant?
Is one, relevant?
Where that limit is giving the dominant effect.
Well, yes, okay, then we get into
population. It would just so if I take the number of themes equals 1, it just would mean that there's only one allele. And so if you now have a population with several themes, is that limit somehow for a natural population?
Yeah, so if you take a single population, then the result is trivial because there's no dominance, so the best one wins.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Okay. So if we're going to get into what you expect to find, if we're not more realistic and you put in mutation, I'm talking at the locus level, so it might be 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6, you'll find a whole bunch of alleles at extremely low frequencies. And you'll have to infer that that's mutation selection balance rather than this, right? Is that satisfactory answer? I mean, the real world is never going to look exactly like any model in biology.
This is kidding. No, but my question was...
Okay, maybe I didn't understand your question. I was admitting that you, in the real world, if you're able to detect alleles that are very infrequent, then you will not see this. But you'll know that they're very infrequent. Go ahead, please, because I'm not sure I've answered you.
Yeah.
I thought I did, but maybe not.
I need to think about it.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
Good. Well, that's all right. So I want to first consider the case. It's a little easier in some ways. Well, certainly the proofs are easier, but that maybe isn't relevant. When migration is weak. Okay. So although I'm not giving you proofs, the proofs require you, of course, to be precise. So I fix all the fitnesses. Okay. And then I say that the backward migration matrix has very little migration, and that means, of course, it's very close to the Kronecker delta. And epsilon is a small positive parameter, which is going to go to zero. That means that there's weak migration. Okay, so what we have now is a perturbation problem. We turn off migration totally, epsilon is zero, and then we have the pure selection system. This is the classical selection system, except for all the subscripting and superscripting that I have added. Okay? And now I have to make an assumption. Okay, it's a generically correct assumption, but we want to make it because otherwise things aren't true. And I'm going to always display assumptions like this with the section number and so forth. And I'm going to assume that the unperturbed system, every equilibrium is hyperbolic. Okay, that just means that there are no eigenvalues whose modulus is one. Okay, because if you perturb one of those, you get into trouble. So that's generically true. Okay, and then we have the theorem, which, as you see, is partly written down and partly plagiarized from our paper, depending on how I wanted to change things. So the model, I assume the model holds, and I assume that migration is weak, and that this assumption holds. And then I fix all the fitnesses, as already stated, and now I consider that epsilon is positive but sufficiently large. And then I have from that three conclusions. Okay? So what I really want to know is conclude something about the full system with weak selection. So the zero migration system has some set of equilibria, which I call sigma naught, and they're in our favored space. Okay? And this contains only isolated points because I assume this. I realize none of this is obvious. I'm just telling you that it's true. Okay. This is then also true for the set sigma sub epsilon of the weak selection equilibria of the full system. More than that, as epsilon goes to zero, these equilibria converge to those. Okay. So that's the first conclusion. That's a local conclusion, but it's true everywhere. Okay. Second one is also local. And I'm sorry, it's a little bit complicated. So in the neighborhood of each asymptotically stable equilibrium point in sigma naught, okay, that is the unperturbed system, there exists exactly one equilibrium point of sigma epsilon. Okay, so I have an equilibrium inside or on the boundary that's asymptotically stable. Then if I make a neighborhood, there is one in that neighborhood. And of course, if epsilon goes to zero, it converges to it. And it has the same stability. It's asymptotically stable. Now, in the neighborhood of each unstable internal equilibrium point in sigma naught, there exists exactly one equilibrium point in sigma epsilon, and it is unstable. So the same story and the same stability. Okay? On the boundary, you have to be very careful. Okay? In the neighborhood of each unstable boundary equilibrium, we have already covered the asymptotically stable ones. Okay? On the boundary or inside. But if you have an unstable boundary equilibrium, okay, there exists at most one equilibrium point in sigma epsilon, and if it exists, it's unstable. Now, why the difference? The difference is that when you turn on migration and you have an unstable equilibrium point on the boundary, it can move outside and it ceases to be biologically relevant. It, of course, doesn't go away, but it becomes irrelevant to us. That's what happens. Again, it's something you have to write out and think about, but it's true. Okay, and then the major conclusion, in a way, is that for sufficiently small epsilon, P of T converges to one of the equilibria in sigma epsilon. So here we do have convergence. Why does that work? Because it has been proved, actually independently, as is sometimes the case, in the former Soviet Union and in the United States, it has been proved that the pure selection system converges. That's a result from only the early 80s, actually. It's not not a very easy result. Okay, and then if you perturb it, but very weakly, it still converges. Okay, so that's the weak selection limit, if you like. And I'll just say a couple of things about it. Despite what I said in the theorem, in fact, by any reasonable definition of the mean fitness, it can decrease. You can construct examples easily enough that decrease, no matter how small the epsilon is. So even though when epsilon is zero, it's always increasing or non-decreasing, it's not true for small epsilon. Okay. And I'll give you an application of it. There are many others. So let me assume now that dominance is intermediate. By that I mean that underdominance and overdominance are absent. Okay, so the heterozygote is not outside the interval, the closed interval formed by the two homozygotes, for every pair of alleles. Okay? Then, without migration, that is in pure selection, generically, not always, but generically, some allele is fixed in every deem. This seems like a totally elementary result, but I don't think it was proved before 2006. It's not quite as simple as you might think, because when you have multiple alleles, for two alleles it's trivial. For multiple alleles, the behavior of gene frequencies is not monotone. So it doesn't come quite as easily, and at least I'm not aware that it was proved earlier. It's somewhat surprising. It is, of course, biologically, if you like, obvious. But one wants to know not just that it's obvious, but that it's also true. Okay, so therefore, when there's no migration, there's a globally asymptotically stable equilibrium with at most K alleles present. Okay? And now the theorem tells us that for sufficiently weak migration, the gene frequencies converge globally to an equilibrium with exactly the same set of K alleles present. Okay. Maybe you have to think a little about it, but that's one type of application of this kind of result. Because you have delineated the equilibrium and you know that it converges. Okay.
Can you give some kind of hand-waving arguments as to why the number of deems should affect the number of alleles then?
No, because if I could give you a hand-waving argument, I would say that I understand the result and I have intuition for it. I thought very long and hard about it. I will get back to this point, and I will tell you my failed hypothesis and rule it out, but I can't give you a...
Well, can selection be different in each of the genes?
Yes, of course. I thought the gentleman was getting back to the first theorem, or...
I'm just trying to understand why increasing the number of deems allows more alleles to be stable, to be present in the equilibrium, and it must be because...
That's turning it around. That doesn't bother me. Then I have different selection regimes. But yes, okay. I meant that the first theorem I gave you, I don't understand the reason for it, but okay.
Selection the same, then it doesn't make any difference, does it? The
selection. Yeah, I will talk about uniform selection, but only toward the end of the second talk, if I remember correctly, toward the end. So I'm assuming that it varies arbitrarily. Okay? Yeah. All right. So probably a more interesting and more important case, which I'll revert to later again, is strong migration. Okay. The intuition here, I think, is fairly clear, but it's fairly difficult to prove. What one wants to say is that when migration dominates selection, you average everything, and there's very little variation. But it turns out that you don't average things in quite as obvious a way as you might have expected, and it's actually a much harder thing to prove. Okay, so now I do it the same way as before, but now I fix the migration matrix, the backward migration matrix, and I say that there's no selection. A point I didn't make that all the population geneticists know here is all these fitnesses are relative, they occur only as ratios, so there's no loss of generality if I normalize to one. Okay? If you remember that map 2.1, that's true. So I now have my selection coefficients and I have my small parameter epsilon, small positive parameter, and I fix these selection coefficients and let epsilon get small. Okay, we can't do this quite generally, but we make a generic assumption that M is ergodic, which is a term I use. I don't think it's totally standard, which means irreducible and aperiodic. Okay? some people say a cyclic, whatever. It's a decent matrix. By the way, for a finite M, this assumption is very weak. If I assume irreducibility, which if there's anyone here who's not familiar, it means that eventually from any beam you can reach every other beam, then all you need is one positive diagonal element and you get a periodicity. You can think about it for yourself. It's actually a problem in Feller. There's a view that 90% of what you need in probability theory is in Feller, 5% is in all the other books taken together, and 5% isn't known. I tend to subscribe to that. Okay. So if this assumption is made, then as those of you who know the Perrin-Frobenius theory will immediately know that there is a vector which I can take to have positive components, and I call it V here, which is the principal left eigenvector of M. Okay, and it turns out to be what you need to average. That is not a total shock. V is, if M generated a Markov chain, V would be its stationary distribution. In more genetic terms, if I sample a gene from beam K, and I ask what is the probability, as I trace back its ancestry, as you learned a lot from Dick and Bob Griffiths, that T generations ago, it was in beam L, that probability converges to V sub L, regardless of what K is. So there are good reasons why that V is very important. Okay, and I don't know, because I didn't ask my friend Ewan, at what level of generality. Are you going to have Psi in the talk?
No.
Okay, then he will not be talking about the PDE analog. The function in our papers called Psi is the analog of the V. Okay, so he'll, I gather, probably just talk about Laplacian. Okay. So I average things this way. Okay, remember this was a K component vector. So this is scalar. And then I formed vector, on this kind of thing, capitals and lowercase are hard to distinguish. But I thought it'd be too ugly to use lined paper, which is actually how I do all my work. So that's in the simplex. These are the average frequencies. And what you need to do, again, I consider this quite intuitive. Instead of analyzing the gene frequencies, P, you analyze the mean and the deviations from the mean. That's the first thing you have to do this. And these are, of course, easy to define, just the deviations from the mean, and they form a vector like this in RJ, and then all of them collected like this. Okay? So these are just deviations at various levels. This is in beam K, and this is all of them. And I have to average the selection coefficients the same way with the V. So the rows are average selection coefficients in that population, averaged with this convenient beast. Of course, the V is only useful if it turns out to work, and it does. Okay, and it becomes obvious when you do the analysis that that's what you need. It wasn't obvious to me before ever working on anything like this. Okay. So when migration becomes stronger and stronger, with this little footprint of migration called the V, we expect a panmictic system. Okay. So I have to scale time. Okay. And I do that this way because, remember, t is an integer, so I don't want to say that tau is equal to epsilon t, because then t needn't be an integer. So what I get then is that the average system is just what you expect. Dpi by d tau is, this is the standard continuous approximation of discrete selection model. Fitness of AI, as we sometimes say, to be brief, the selection coefficient of AI less the mean selection coefficient, and Q, of course, is zero in that limit. Okay, so other than hyperbole, so we already had to make the assumption that M was ergodic, and I again make a hyperbolicity assumption. I'm going kind of slowly, so I shouldn't talk so long about each little thing. And then we have a theorem. Okay? So we have our basic model. We have ergodicity. 4.1 was the assumption that selection is weak. We have the ergodicity of M, and we have hyperbolicity. M is fixed, epsilon is positive and sufficiently small. It's similar to the other. The result in some ways is simpler, but it's much harder to prove. Okay, the set of equilibria, let's say xi naught, of the zero migration system contains only isolated points because of this. What did I say?
It's not zero migration.
Zero selection, thank you, yes. Absolutely. Yes. That's okay. And it contains only isolated equilibria, and that's true for small enough epsilon for the exact system. And again, as epsilon converges to zero, each of these equilibria converges to the corresponding one, which is unperturbed. And it turns out now that you can't lose an equilibrium by moving out of your biologically acceptable space, delta sub jk. So in the neighborhood of each equilibrium point in sigma naught, there exists exactly one equilibrium point, sorry, xi naught, xi epsilon, and the stability of this one is the same as that of the unperturbed one. So each pair is either asymptotically stable or unstable. We can't just have stable without asymptotic stability because of the hyperbolicity assumption. Okay, and the last conclusion is the same as before, that the exact solution when epsilon is small enough converges to one of the equilibrium points. Okay. Let's say more about this. There is a smooth, globally, geometrically attracting invariant manifold, which I call lambda sum epsilon, such that on that manifold, the deviations are of order epsilon. What we mean, of course, by an invariant manifold is if you start on it, you stay on it. We have absolutely no hope of computing what that is. By computing, I mean analytically. Okay, but we know it exists. So when there is no selection, of course, then the manifold is very simple. Q is zero. There's no variation because migration just equalizes everything. But we know, sort of from dynamical systems, what some people would call abstract nonsense, that there is such an invariant manifold. And we know that you approach it at a geometric rate, say kappa 1. And the time is such that if t is bigger than what I call t tilde, which is not a very long time. Indeed, epsilon is small, but it's a logarithm, and the logarithm of something is not that huge. So pretty rapidly, I will actually give you a picture this time soon. After that time, q is of order epsilon, and then you approach this thing. Okay. So there's a second theorem. I want to put it all together in the example, so I'm delaying the example. Okay. Second theorem has to do with the mean fitness. This is a much nicer case than weak selection because we actually have non-decreasing mean fitness. So let's say that all those assumptions of the theorem apply. Okay. Now I have to be a little bit careful because when the population starts, you may have very large gene frequency deviations, and then all hell is going, and I can't say anything about it. The mean fitness we know very well can decrease during that period. And then at the end of the story, I have to be careful, because when you are close to equilibrium, everything has slowed down, and things are changing so slowly that you can get a failure. So I have to bound the average gene frequencies away from the equilibrium. Okay, and I have to assume that P is within order epsilon squared of the invariant manifold. And in that case, the mean fitness is increasing, provided you define it appropriately. And of course, the appropriate definition is to average them in each deem by our friend V, the stationary distribution. Okay, Now, this, of course, looks kind of abstract, but don't worry about it, because if t is bigger than 2t tilde, which is still just twice the logarithm, essentially, then p is within order epsilon squared. Also, we computed the rate of change, and what you have here is a generalization of Fisher's fundamental theorem of natural selection, because the rate of change, delta W bar, is in fact a genic variance of the panmictic population with allelic frequencies rho and selection coefficients, sorry, allelic frequencies p and selection coefficients rho. That is, the genic variance is a term we use for the additive component of the total genetic variance, extracted as Fisher taught us to do in 1918. So it generalized us. From this result, you can construct an example, which I won't show you, but the conclusion is interesting, that arbitrarily many alleles can be maintained in globally asymptotically stable equilibrium in just two deems with partial dominance. And in fact, this is not a non-generic example because it holds for an open set of parameters. This does not contradict the first theorem because this is partial dominance. It does not work if there's no dominance. See, no dominance is very special here. Okay, so that's an application of this thing. Okay. So how does the system actually behave, finally? The simplest case is to take two diallelic beams, and then I can actually draw a picture. Okay, so p tilde was this, I'm just reminding you. The characteristic time to convergence, or what physicists call relaxation time, is of order 1 over epsilon. This is, of course, a sketch. It's not a computation. There's no point in picking parameters and computing the thing. One knows qualitatively what it does. So let's say that initially there is a large difference between the frequencies and the beams. That's going to be rapidly reduced by migration, because migration is very strong. Okay? And then we start approaching this invariant manifold. This is lambda naught, and this is our invariant manifold, lambda epsilon. And you come closer and closer to it. After time 2 t tilde, you're order epsilon squared away, and then you kind of slide just off it, closer and closer. And then we have to be bounded away from the equilibrium. We know it converges. And on this whole part, which you notice, depending on your outlook on population genetics, is exactly the region where most of the gene frequency change occurs. And one view of the world, it's not the only view of the world, is that what is really important is gene frequency change. So during that part, it's very nice because the mean fitness is increased. Okay, so that summarizes part of what I showed you. I have to be careful and not say that I proved for you, because I didn't prove any of it for you. Okay. The break time is fixed at 3:15.
When is coffee break generally?
Pardon? That cannot be adjusted to content. It's like a fugue. Regardless of the content, it has a certain. Pardon? Yeah, I'm just looking at how much I have on the Levine model, and. But I suppose that means that we can go a little late, because it doesn't make sense to stop in the middle of a section, I think. That's fine. Okay, let's do the Levine model. Okay, I promised you that one advantage of discrete time, discrete space, discrete time, let's keep the order that way, is that there is one case that is somewhat tractable, and that's the Levine model. It goes back to 1953 in a simple case of two alleles. That works like this. You have a certain constant proportion of adults in each deem, okay, which I will call C sub K. And this is after selection, but before migration. Okay? So C is in the interior of this K-dimensional simplex, because we're not looking at deems where there's nobody. Okay? And the fundamental assumption in the approach that I have taken is that the backward migration matrix depends only on where you came from. You're more likely to come from a big deem than a small one. It doesn't matter where you are. Okay? Now, the way to interpret this biologically is that, that would be the next one. It's the fan from the machine. Is that you have a whole bunch of deems, K deems, but the individuals don't mate there. They go form a mating group, like the Arctic skew, and they all go to the Arctic, or the harp seals go there to be clubbed by the Canadians. And they mate at random, and then they go and redistribute themselves at random. Okay, that's biologically the same thing as what I wrote for you. Okay, so it falls in this framework, but it's not really a geographical variation model, because all it is that you have different selection regimes, but you're not going to get some nice Klein in which you have small people here and big people there or anything like that. Okay, what makes this model far more tractable is reduction in dimensionality, because after one generation, you can see immediately from the recursion relation 2.1, the frequencies in zygotes are the same in all the deems. Okay, so we can simplify the notation, and for the Levine model, Pi of t is just the frequency of Ai in zygotes in generation t, and then the vector p now of all the gene frequencies is just delta j. So that's the same space as a random mating model. And in fact, the recursion is a simple average of random mating selection. It's this. Okay? So now, whatever results we get, we'll be applying to this one. And that's a much simpler map, where, just to be clear, I rewrote the allelic fitnesses and the mean fitness like this. Okay? There are many results for two alleles that I'm not giving you, which would be intuitive, but there's just not the time. Okay, we need to define the geometric mean fitness, and it's just this, and there's a very important theorem, somewhat sordid history. There's a completely incorrect proof here, and there's a proof with a big gap there. So again, it's dirty. But in any case, it's true that the geometric mean fitness cannot decrease, and it has it's constant. It doesn't change only at equilibrium, and that's a very powerful tool. Of course, it's a Lyapunov function. Okay, so we immediately conclude that generically the equilibria of the system 5.2 is our system are isolated, in which case P of t converges, right? Just basically Lyapunov. Okay, so here's something for you to prove. I would conjecture that P of t always converges. That's not known. Why is there something to prove? Because you can have a manifold of equilibria. We don't know. It's the same problem as for pure selection, except there it's been proved. Okay? So I'm going to make an assumption now, and that's pretty recent. I'm going to assume, to give you some detailed results, what I call deem-independent degree of intermediate dominance. And what that means is there exist constants alpha ij, which are deem-independent, such that I can write every fitness in this form. This is the AIAI homozygote. This is the JJ, AJAJ homozygote. And this is just the weighting, but it's independent of deem. So it's between 0 and 1. And of course, I want this to be symmetric, so alpha ji had better be 1 minus alpha ij. Now, this actually makes some sense biologically. When I say it makes some sense, I'm not asserting that it's always true or it's true 47% of the time. I'm just saying it's biologically intuitive. What it's saying is even though selection is varying from deem to deem, gene action is not. So that when you take any pair of alleles, relatively where that heterozygote is located, it depends on the pair of alleles, but not which deem it's in. Okay? The unfortunate thing is that although this is marvelous for the Levine model, at least so far as I can see, it doesn't tell you anything about the general model. Maybe it does, and it hasn't been discovered. But in the Levine model, it turns out to be the key to extending a whole bunch of results from no dominance to this, which is a much more general case. Okay, so here is the theorem. We have our recursion, and we have the assumption I just made, which we call DIDID. And then the following statements are true, or at least are thought to have been proved by me. There exists exactly one stable equilibrium, and it is globally attractive. Okay? If there exists an internal equilibrium, it is globally asymptotically stable. Okay? And the number of deems minus any neutral deems is a generic upper bound on the number of alleles present at equilibrium. I am not repeating myself. I made that statement at the beginning, but that was for general migration and only no dominance. Here, because it's a simpler model, I can make that same statement more generally. Now, I promised at that time that I would return to my biological failure to understand that result, which I still fail to understand. Okay, so my idea was, originally, in the case of no dominance, that everybody had to be the best somewhere. And if you have only K deems, you're not going to have more than K alleles. Now, depends if you're a computational person, you might start doing searches and running things. My way of looking at it was to construct a model, and indeed I could find a globally asymptotically stable equilibrium where none of the three alleles was the best anywhere. So that goes into the can, and that's what I mean. I don't have any other ideas. That idea is false. You don't have to be the best somewhere. So I don't know why it works, but it's true. This actually is not easy to prove. Okay, so because the geometric mean fitness is a Lyapunov function, you don't do it by, or at least I don't, by transforming the recursion. They're very messy. But qualitatively, the Lyapunov function tells you everything. And what I found is that it's possible to find a homeomorphism that reduces, under this assumption, the geometric mean fitness to the same form as no dominance. I can invert it only when there's no genotype dependence, but I know that it's a homeomorphism. So that qualitatively tells you this. I guess we're okay then. So we should stop here, I think, then, because I'm going to go to continuous time next.
I have a question.
Yes.
Regarding the special migration pattern assumed in this.
A special one, you said?
No, for this model that you just described to us.
Oh, then, yes.
The special matrix for
Yes. Yes.
Now, natural for a physicist is something that is diffusion.
Yes.
And so how would this matrix
you look can't.
Like if you
had. You can't.
Well, of course.
You're talking about the Levine model?
No, not the Levine model. I would like to, I'm interested in...
Oh, you mean the general model?
The migration matrix.
Yes.
For a model where...
Yes.
I mean a natural one, where you have big populations and the flow out of the big population is proportional to its size. Yeah. Right. I would expect that the migration matrix, for instance, MKLL, is actually something like the ratio of CK over CL instead of what you assume in this Levine model.
Well, wait. The Levine model is strictly discrete and it's not spatial really and doesn't have a diffusion limit. In point of fact, if you make selection weak, it's quite easy to see. The Levine model just gives you random mating. The idea that MKL should be CK over CL is not tenable because what you proposed to me is not stochastic. Sum over L of MKL has to be 1 for every K.
So the inverse.
Anyway, there is a diffusion limit, and that's what Ewan will talk about. You're just going to talk about isotropic, the Laplacian, right? Yeah, there's a general diffusion limit, and so I should say, and what you get a semilinear parabolic system, and migration then is described by a general elliptic operator, and you have a selection term, and you need to also derive the boundary condition, because you already started to talk in terms of flow. That's a rather dangerous way to think, because densities flow, gene frequencies don't, because gene frequencies are ratios. So if Ewan were, one advantage would be of right, pardon me? No, they don't flow. I mean, there's change, but no, because they're ratios. So ratios of quantities that flow. So if we wrote for you the general elliptic operator, it would not look right to you, because it's not a conservation law. I know exactly what you're thinking. It's not that P sub T is the divergence of something. There are special cases like that, but in general, it's not like that. Secondly, if we wrote for you the boundary condition, you would also not recognize it, because it doesn't look like a zero flux condition, because it's a condition on a ratio. You just have to do the whole thing out. It's not quite that easy. But anyway, I don't know about the CK over CL. That wouldn't be a model. Maybe you could elaborate it. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Maybe help, because this might be a point that comes up later. I think what Oscar meant was not diffusion in gene frequency space, but diffusion in space. So
that is what I thought he meant.
Right. So the point is that the question is what would the migration matrix look like if you have in mind a spatially structured population, so you have deems in different places, and there is some exchange between the deems, which depends on the distance between them, which implies that you have sort of more exchange. So
yes.
In the simplest case, you have some neighbor relationship, and then these
Well, in the simplest case, then you could say that MKL depends on the absolute difference between K and L. And it's a monotone decreasing function of that. That's perfectly okay.
So that would be a model that is.
That's entirely reasonable in my view. Yes, that's right.
So I think that when physicists say diffusion, they don't necessarily mean that you go to the continuum. I mean, just having discrete things.
Oh, okay.
Where there's an extreme.
To me, diffusion is a specific mathematical process.
Sort of more like like a random walk between.
No. I think to a mathematician, diffusion is a very specific process, Kolmogorov and so on, not something more general. So I misunderstood in that sense, but yeah, I guess. But I was responding as if the question had related to diffusion in space. But yeah. No, I mean, you can make all those models, it's just that you can't solve them in discrete space. Well, actually, as far as explicit solutions are concerned, there are very few that you can do even in continuous space. The diffusion model, I know I'm speaking in the specific sense, it doesn't really have any easy cases. There is, of course, a lot of mathematical machinery, and you'll hear about it from Ewan, but there are no simple special cases. So there are trade-offs. I mean, each of the models is good for some things and not for others. So I mentioned there are some advantages to assuming that everything is happening slowly, which is in fact often the case, and then we can make a simple approximation like this, and then we'll get the model in discrete space and continuous time. So then we assume that all the fitnesses are close to one, by scaling, and migration is also weak, so the rates are mu, and we fix the r's and the mu's and let epsilon go to zero. Okay, the description of the gene frequencies is exactly the same as before, but now, of course, the independent variable is changing continuously. Okay? So, but now we want to define, it's exactly the same as the fitness, it's the selection coefficients like this, selection coefficient of AI, the mean selection coefficient in AI in DMK, mean selection coefficient in DMK, and now, because this is a stochastic matrix, the mu KL will be non-negative when K is not equal to L, and they'll, of course, sum to zero in each row. Okay? And we scale as we did before, right? You always have to get on the right time scale, the time scale of the evolutionary process, which here is epsilon per generation. So you have to use a slower clock. Okay? So you do it this way, and I didn't want to burden you with too much notation, so I rescaled and went back to T. Okay? So then you get, instead of the recursion relation that we had, which was 2.1, we get this continuous model. Okay? And the first part, of course, is migration. Second part is selection. And they're now additive because, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't
say. UKL are greater than equal to zero and they sum up to zero?
They're only greater than or equal to zero when off the diagonal. The diagonal elements are all negative.
Okay.
It's like a continuous Markov chain, the rates in a continuous Markov chain. Okay? They're rates. The others were probabilities. Okay? I mean, right? If I sum this over L, I get one on the left-hand side, I get one there, so those have to be zero. It's sort of standard continuous time Markov chain stuff. Okay. All right, so what I will discuss next, which, are you going to discuss it in the diffusion? The loss of an allele? Okay, so you will hear about this in different pictures, is sufficient conditions for loss of an allele. If you were to ask me why I didn't do that in discrete time, it's because I don't know how. I know how to do it in the Levine model, but I think there's a limit to how much it's sensible to put in. And I don't think that adding more would be good. Maybe I'm putting in too much. So in the Levine model, it's possible to do it. In general, we can't figure it out. So if you like, that would be a nice open problem when evolution is happening fairly fast. Can you find sufficient conditions for the loss of an allele? Okay. I suppose later on I must mention, in case I don't, I should say that what would be even more important to find conditions for protecting an allele. That's very hard to do unless you have only two alleles, and we don't really have strong results. There is a weak result. I don't know whether UN is going to present it. Weak in that, in the sense that the assumptions are very strong. Okay. But for loss of an allele, it's possible to develop something, and I'm going to use the vector U to be the vector of ones in RK. And then, as before, I have to make assumptions. The first one is simple, M is irreducible. The second, of course, is the real assumption. And it's kind of complicated. So I'm going to be interested in the loss, finding sufficient conditions for the loss of the allele AI. So that the stuff is not empty, I say there is some I in the set of indices, so there's an AI in the set of alleles, and that there exist constants gamma ij, which are non-negative, the diagonal is zero, and they add up to one. Okay? So that's the constants. we have no prescription for finding these constants. Nonetheless, there are results you can derive from this very strange-looking theorem. Okay, so if there exist constants that satisfy this, which have this property. Now, this property, I think, is somewhat intuitive. I won't go so far as say anything is obvious, but it's somewhat intuitive because this is actually a probability measure, right? So I'm taking a certain peculiar kind of average over the fitnesses of the alleles A sub J for each deem, and say that that peculiar average exceeds the fitness, I keep saying fitness, I mean selection coefficient of the allele A sub I. But the problem is the gammas can't depend on the deem, and this has to be true in every deem. So it's a pretty strong assumption. And this has to be true for every vector such that PIK is positive, so the allele is present. Okay, and then worse than that, I have to define a set capital gamma sub I for each I such that the lowercase gammas are positive. And then I assume initially the allele is there, and whenever an allele is in this set, that it's present. Okay? And then from all of that, you can prove, okay, so 6.2 was the continuous model, and 7.2 is this horrid stuff, and A7.1 is just technical irreducibility. And after all of that, you can prove that PI goes to zero. And that's because all this junk allows you to find the Lyapunov function. Okay, as I say, these things are very non-monotone. Okay, so
the statement is it goes to zero, or it goes to zero at finite time?
Oh, no, it just goes to zero.
But that doesn't mean that it's ever zero, right?
That's correct. In fact, generically, no. You would have to have lethality of dominance and so on. No, it doesn't. It just converges to zero. We're not even saying it converges geometrically.
That's not obviously really a loss of an allele, right? Because you have an infinite population. So.
Because what? Well, in the real world, you don't have an infinite population. I mean, right? In the real world, you have random drift. Once the allele frequency is too low, or if you want me to argue differently, I would say in the real world, beyond a certain point, you'll never see it. How big is your sample going to be?
That will then depend on how quickly it approaches zero, right? If it goes like 1/(log t), it would be large.
That would not be expected, but remember, evolution has been going on for quite some time. Yes?
In the real world, as we've heard in the morning, biologists are arguing that if the allele frequency is 95%, it's fixed.
Yeah, often. I mean, that's maybe a little excessive, but as technology becomes better. But I would argue that that's a real result. It doesn't really matter whether the allele is there. I can't recall. I'm sorry. Were you made the point about mutation, or was it someone else?
No, this was someone else.
Yeah, okay. But beyond a certain point, mutation is going to keep it in there too, right? At maybe a frequency of 10 to the minus 5 or even.
I'm trying to understand what you mean by loss of an allele in that sense.
I mean that in this model, the frequency converges to zero, which I think in the real world means that you won't see it, except at a very, very low rate. And that will not be because it hasn't reached zero, it'll be because of mutation. Okay? So, first, because of these strong assumptions, this is not a necessary condition. We can find examples where you lose the allele, even though these conditions don't work. Now, there are many applications of this, surprisingly enough, because you're free to pick systems where there is such a gamma. So I'll just give you one, not to bore you too much. Okay, so suppose there's intermediate dominance, that is, no overdominance, no underdominance. Okay, and the homozygotes have the same order in every deem. Okay, now we're talking examples, so I'm not asserting that this is going to necessarily be commonly found or not. Okay, so that means I can order them so that the lower the index, the higher the selection coefficient. And because I said that dominance is intermediate, the heterozygote is going to be in between. Okay? And now, if I make the assumption like this, that A1 AI in every deem is fitter than AI AI, if I is bigger than 1, then P1 is fixed. That you can prove from this theorem, because you go step by step. Okay, you lose AJ, then you lose AJ1, and so on. Okay, so that's what I told you, that I think it would be biologically very important to find conditions for protecting an allele. There's a long, long literature on the idea of protecting polymorphism from Haldane. Might have been the first, maybe about 1963, to work on it. But that's a very difficult problem. Why? Because you're in this delta JK, and you don't know the equilibrium structure, you don't know whether you have convergence, so on and so forth. But anything that could be done, I think, would be very interesting. We can finish everything today. Depending on how long you... Actually, you're running things, so you tell me how long I should go. I guess because it wasn't entirely clear to me. I can continue. It doesn't matter. Let's see. How long is this section? It's this is 3 overheads. I mean, I can certainly do the rest tomorrow easily, or go on and have less tomorrow. I mean, I'm happy to go on. I didn't mean in any way to. Whatever is the custom or preference here.
Custom, as far as I can tell. You have time tomorrow, so.
Well, let's see. Are you implying I should stop or not?
No.
Do one more section. We did almost nothing. We did almost nothing after we came back. Pardon me?
Yeah, do this and then the rest you know.
That's what I was thinking. Thank you. I don't want to do something that I'm the only one. Okay, so this is an issue I have had a long interest in since 1980, and it's the following biological question. I think it's obvious that most species, unless they're headed, unfortunately, for extinction fairly soon, have some spatial distribution. Not all, but I think most. Nonetheless, it's also true, and I'm not qualified to say, Marty could be more accurate perhaps, that very often you don't see spatial variation in the gene frequencies. So that immediately raises the question of why that is the case. Now, I already gave you one answer to that, but I didn't raise the question. It's strong migration, right? If migration is so strong, then the deviations are going to be tiny and you don't see it. Another possibility is that selection doesn't vary in space. Now, that raises some difficult problems because, at least in my opinion, the probability is zero that the initial data were the same all over. The one thing, there's random variation and so on. So then you have a quite non-trivial problem on your hands, because then you're being asked to show that you converge to what would be the local equilibrium at every point globally that has no spatial variation. So that is how I see the problem of uniform selection. Some of these things, I might say, you kind of have to think about in a mathematical way, otherwise you might not even see the problem. And I think this is maybe one of those cases. Okay, so I'm going to show you a number of results. The first one is actually pretty simple. And first, what do we mean by uniform selection? So that I state as an assumption. It just means, and I apologize for abusing the notation, but I don't want to add even more symbols, is that Wij, K doesn't depend on the deem. Okay? So the fitnesses are the same everywhere. But it's still a subdivided population. Okay, remind you, 8.1, the pure selection system. You saw this when we discussed weak migration. And again, to remind you, allelic fitness, mean fitness. Okay, of course I have to make some kind of assumption to make things tractable, so I'm going to assume when there is no migration, every equilibrium is hyperbolic. Okay? And then it's actually fairly easy to show this laboriously written statement, or is several statements. Okay, so what I just told you, this is our basic model, the discrete model. We're back, I didn't emphasize it, in discrete time, discrete space, for now. And then we have the hyperbolicity, we have uniformity and hyperbolicity. Okay, now let's suppose that there's a uniform equilibrium, p caret, so that in every deem it's the same. So this object zeta is in delta j. We have the same equilibrium everywhere, okay, independent of k. Okay, then first, and this is trivial to see, from the equations, then this equilibrium is an equilibrium of the full system with any amount of migration. Okay, well, of course, everything is the same, so migration doesn't change anything. And secondly, this equilibrium, p caret, is either asymptotically stable for both 8.1 and 2.1, that is, without migration or with the full migration, or it's unstable for both. That's not as obvious, but it's true. So if I may rephrase it less formally, what it means is uniform hyperbolic equilibria persist under migration without changing stability. Okay? Okay. What is quite a bit harder to do is, but this is just local, so it really doesn't tell you nearly as much as you would like. What you really want, as I was just trying to convey to you, is prove something global. Okay, if you can do something in discrete time, that would be very good. We couldn't. Okay, so I have to go to the continuous time model, the slow evolution model, and I don't know whether Ewan will talk about it. We can also get these results in the PDE model. Okay, so I assume that the selection coefficients, this is just uniformity, don't depend on the beam, and I define them like that. Okay, so the RI and the R bar, of course, don't need to be subscripted, right? Because they just depend on the frequencies. And then I have a pure selection model like this, except that I find my first misprint, which is that there's no I there. Sorry. Three times I read the thing over, and there's still a misprint. Okay. Okay, now we have to, of course, make an assumption on how the selection system behaves. So we assume that the system has a uniform, globally asymptotically stable internal equilibrium point p caret. Okay. I don't like that, but we can't go beyond it, so that's an open problem. I don't think that assumption is necessary. And I don't think this is necessary either, or at least it can be weakened, but again, it's just technical. There's a lot of messing around with the Lyapunov function and convexity and so on, and we couldn't do better. So all the migration rates are assumed to be positive, okay, when k is not equal. And then if p of 0 is in the interior, and everything I said to you above, hyperbolicity and all of that holds, then p of t converges to p caret. P caret was the uniform equilibrium. Okay, but the two aspects that I think are too strong is one that somehow we can't do it when it's on the boundary because of just all the manipulation that goes into it, uses certain things, and this is probably too strong. So because this is strong, we have another result in which we don't make this assumption, but instead we assume that migration is symmetric. Okay, why does that work? Because then we have, here is one Lyapunov function ultimately gives you this, a different one gives you this. Okay, so if P of 0, but only in the interior, and all this stuff holds, and new symmetric and so on, then this happens, that you ultimately don't have spatial variation. Okay? So I would conjecture that theorems 8.2 and 8.4 hold on the boundary. But funny things can happen on the boundary, but it's difficult for me biologically to see why that shouldn't be true. Now, we have some corollaries in this paper from last year. When migration is either weak or strong, then the statement is true. But we don't have it in general. Okay, so I guess then the consensus is that this should be the stopping point. Yeah, I would be very sorry. I should say I'd be very happy to answer questions if I can. Thank you. I'll give